Good morning, everyone. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. Mary Griffith, host of The Mary Griffith Show, brought to you by Harvest Ridge Coffee from Refreshment Services Pepsi. A man who knows a lot about a lot, Jack Freiberg, is my guest today. He's with the Historical Society of Quincy and Adams County, and we were talking just a moment ago with Lucia Geisey about cultured and freshwater pearls, and you have a story.
Well, a lot of people don't realize, but they use our mussels from around here to go into the oyster in order to make the cultured pearls, because it has something to do, I guess, with the close symmetry that it really irritates the oyster to make the pearl. But when you see these guys out there with the drag lines that are pulling up these mussels that are here locally, that's what they go for. That's where they go. The guys get paid by the ton for them, and I know it's become a lot more restrictive.
So they put like crushed up shell?
Yeah, exactly.
Irritate. Ah, because they see it as a close cousin. What are you doing in my shell? Get out of here.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't want my brother-in-law sleeping on my couch. I'm going to build a pearl around him.
Exactly.
And isolate him. Interesting. Well, I love mussels, so next time I'll save my shells. And I'll get myself an oyster, and I'll make my own pearl.
There you go.
But I've got nothing to do the next
5 years.
Quite
the endeavor.
Quite the endeavor. Jack is here to talk about the Historical Society of Quincy and Adams County. The annual meeting is Sunday at 1, and that won't be too exciting. How are we going to sugarcoat that any other way than that? But we'll find out some great things that have happened and some great plans that are going forward. But I think immediately following that, the dessert for the annual meeting is Professor Justin Coffey, Dr. Justin Coffey from Quincy University, who's a historian, is writing a book called Nixon, A New Look at His Legacy. And Dr. Coffey's going to speak about Richard Nixon at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. It's free of charge. The public is welcome. This should be an interesting talk.
Well, he's already written a book about Spiro Agnew. And I think this is looking at the bigger picture here with Nixon and his legacy and the good things and the bad things that came out of the Nixon administration. Because I remember at the time, I don't know about you, but I think there's certain times in your life where you all knew where you were, you know, Kennedy's death and the September 11th event and what have you. And you always know where you are when you find out about these things. And when I found about Nixon resigning, I was in a English composition class in college, and we kind of skipped class that day to watch all the news coverage and watch Nixon address the nation where he actually resigned. And, you know, one of the things that at that time kind of ticked me off was when Gerald Ford went ahead and pardoned Nixon. But I look back at that now, and that was absolutely the right thing to do.
Because we would have had a mess on our hands like we do now with Donald Trump. Some people say Donald Trump is absolutely guilty of a crime. Other people say, okay, but why are we just dragging it out? What do we really think is going to happen to him, even if he's found guilty? He's not going to get life in prison or anything like that. So, you know, there's two schools of thought. Move forward. But if you do move forward and you don't punish people, then you, of course, kind of incur bad doing. However, bad doing was easier to cover up back during Nixon's day.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things now that is a very interesting thing, I've only watched a couple episodes, but it's that Gaslit that's with Sean Penn and Julia Roberts, which goes back into that period of time about the John Dean and the Mitchells and their relationships and John Dean meeting his future wife and all that, which brings that period of time back to memory very well.
But we always remember Mrs. Dean sitting there with her big bouffant hairdo, the loyal wife behind her husband. And then, of course, Margaret Mitchell became a celebrity in her own right from the gossip sheets of Washington.
The mouth of the South.
Mouth of the South. So this is going to be interesting. If you think you know about the presidency of Richard Nixon, you will probably learn a whole bunch of things you didn't have any idea about when we take a look at Nixon, A New Look at His Legacy, a presentation by Dr. Justin Coffey. And again, this is absolutely free of charge. It is on Sunday afternoon.
At
2 o'clock. It's going to be hotter than the hinges of Hades, but we'll be inside in the air-conditioned comfort right across the street here at 4th and Main in the History Museum on the Square. The annual meeting is also a time to look back and look forward. And COVID did a number on the Historical Society. You couldn't really have exhibits open. You couldn't have a lot of tours. But we're pretty much back and open now and getting ready for some real new and exciting things to start. So
it's
good.
The exhibit now that's still running is the Quincy's Golden Age. And it has several items, if you haven't been down there to see that, that would be of interest. It's got a nap-eyed wagon inside the building.
I remember the day they brought that in.
Right.
Several nap-eyed bigwigs here standing there, and these poor workers are like, we drop this thing and it rolls down into the river. We're not going to go back to nap-eyed. I think we've lost our jobs.
We're in trouble.
That's a very delicate piece, an original piece, and for nap-eyed to loan that to the Historical Society is very welcome. But you have to be so careful of those artifacts.
And
yeah.
It's also got an original Gardner governor that was the big item that kind of saved the steamships, that added the safety to those, which a lot of people know about, but very few people have actually seen.
We hear about the Gardner Denver Company, and they kept things from blowing up with these governor regulator things on steam. But, yeah, until you look at it and see it and think, wow, you know, good idea to think about that.
Well, and it really revolutionized the steam industry because prior to that governor being designed, almost all those steamships sooner or later blew up, and there were substantial fires when they did that and substantial loss of life. So this was a real innovation that was desperately needed by that industry at the time.
And it started right here in Quincy, Illinois.
Exactly.
Right on the banks of the mighty Mississippi. You know, I think that's one thing that I enjoy about being a member of the Historical Society. I like to understand the old businesses and the old things that were here. The Freiburgs in the brewing business, everybody has a story. Yeah, today they may be a real estate agent, or they may be a banker, or they may be a radio announcer, but back in the day, their family came here for a reason. It was usually to make a lot of money. Quincy at one time had some really wealthy people.
Well, my great-great-great-grandfather, Anton Delabar, we have his branding iron that he originally used to brand barrels that came out of his brewery. And there's actually a blow-up life-size photograph that's up there, both of Henry Nap-eyed and also of my great-great-great-grandfather and my great-great-uncle.
Well, you had to have something. You had to have a wagon to get those beer barrels around. So these were all synergistic people coming to Quincy. I know my family came out of the stove manufacturing operation and also brick manufacturing. And I wish now I knew more, because, of course, now everybody's gone, that could have probably told me a firsthand story. But it is interesting. I know a little bit, but I asked my mother one time, because we drive by, and she goes, oh, Aunt Angie used to live there. Well, you know, it's a beautiful mansion home. It's there in the East End. You know, so what happened to us? Well,
I have always,
you know.
I have always heard made in one, gone in three.
Well, here's one thing that happened. This is kind of interesting. One of my family members on my mother's side was a fabulously wealthy man. But he died of an earache. You know, you don't die of earaches anymore. Well, he left this widow, and she had all the money. So she remarried. So
there he goes.
There went the money. And my mother told me that story. And I go, he died of an earache? Because, of course, my brother had earaches all the time, and I'd had an earache. And I'm like, I didn't know you could die from an earache. And that's one thing when I talk to the kids at the John Wood Mansion. Talk about how John and Anna, isn't her name Anna? Mm-hmm. Anna Streeter, had these kids, but not all of them lived to adulthood.
Right.
And that's really a hard thing for children to understand, because they may know a few classmates that have had cancer, or they know of somebody who passed away in their school, but nothing like, you know, three or four kids a year dropping from some disease.
And that's why there were such large families in the 19th century, because you know, you had these families all the time that had 7, 8, and Chuck's relative that Chuck Schultz's relative that he talks about, I think he had either that family had either 13 or 14 children.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So the first thing we've got coming up is this Sunday at 1 o'clock, the annual meeting, followed at 2 o'clock with refreshments and stuff served. Nixon, A New Look at Their Legacy by Dr. Justin Coffey. And then there's other things coming up. I think you've got your list there, don't you, Jack? I know in July there's a really interesting one.
Yes, that's the...
I've got that, so go ahead. You just talk off of that.
That's the... Or in the Pacific, they're going to talk about Paul Tibbetts, who was here in Quincy, I think in the year 2000, and spoke at that time. He was speaking in the old downtown Holiday Inn.
Yes, I was there. Isn't that now? That was that long ago.
Yeah, and
yet I haven't gotten a day older. How did that happen?
I don't know. It gets biased, doesn't
it? Yeah.
But anyway, I got a signed book that day. And talked to him a little bit, and I most distinctly in his talk, because he's approached quite frequently and said, "How could you kill all those Japanese people? How could you even consider doing that?" And I thought General Tibbetts' response to that was very wonderfully and wise. And he said, "At that point in time, I did not think about the number of Japanese people that I killed. I thought about the number of American boys' lives that I saved, and I think that was 100% the right answer."
I think you're very right. One of those boys was my father, because when I tried to have discussions with my father, he wouldn't talk about stuff like that too much, but because I couldn't understand how anybody could do that, you know.
Right.
And Dad said, well, you know, we were poised to invade Japan.
Was he training for it?
Yeah, my dad was in the Navy, and they were poised for the invasion of Japan. I think one thing you have to, you know, history is interesting, and what a horrible question to ask what most people consider a hero. How could you kill all those people? But when you think about it, that act, and it was an act that was ordered by a president, it was an act that was carried out by CBs and everybody else down the line. If you had a place in that, you are part of that chain that did that. Killed more people instantaneously than anything else in the world
that time. Yep.
And then here's the part that I never could understand as a kid. We saw what it did, and we did it again. But as my father, who had a different perspective on it, said, it was horrible, but after that, they didn't give up. I mean, if you don't give up after that, then that was a clear indication, at least from our perspective, that they were going to fight until every Japanese person was dead and they'd killed as many Americans and others as they possibly could. So you have to look at things in context of, if you do something terrible, drop the bomb and kill all those people, and it doesn't bring somebody to submission, then that person is willing to say, I'll kill every single person on the island of Japan before I'll surrender.
Well, as you say, it's a matter of perspective.
Yeah.
And
history always is a matter of perspective.
Well, it is. And sometimes we learn, but sometimes we also lose of the essence of history at that point in time. And, you know, my good friend Allie Limonstall, who was really a hunting mentor of mine, flew B-24 Liberators in the Pacific Theater. And he told me stories all the time that were just remarkable. And he carried a picture of a Japanese wooden flying ship that was referred to in the Allies code as a Mavis. And he found out like 52 years later, after he shot that down, that wooden ship had the head of security at the Imperial Palace, a submarine commander. And I forget all who else, but it was a whole load of Japanese leaders that were going to an important meeting, and they just happened to come about and did that.
Cutting off the head of the snake?
Exactly.
Okay. Jack Freiberg, my guest today. When is the date of this event where we can hear about the Paul Tibbetts Enola Gay?
July 17th, and it's going to be at the History Museum again.
Okay. We'll take a break. When we come back, our conversation continues. Coming up in just a moment, Gary Rabine, Republican candidate for governor, is scheduled to be a guest on the Mary Griffith Show. We're back. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. Jack Freiberg is here. We're talking about upcoming events at the Historical Society. This Sunday, June 26th at 2, it's Nixon, A New Look at His Legacy. And then coming up in July, it's a conversation about Paul Tibbetts from Quincy. His mother was Enola Gay, and that was the name of the plane, and that plane dropped the atomic bomb. And then we continue into August with even more great things to talk about.
Yes, Saturday, August 13th, and then Sunday the 14th, we're going to have a Lincoln, Grant, and Twain tour, which is going to be at the John Wood Mansion. And we're also going to be doing a rededication of the Grant plaque down on the waterfront. But we're going to have three people there that are going to impersonate each one of those individuals. Kurt Fields is Grant, and he has been here a number of times and is probably the best-known Grant impersonator in the country. So that should be a very good event.
Very, very good event. Coming up this Saturday, it's on right now, but the auction of these items from the boys from Plymouth who mustered in here in Quincy and served in the Civil War. One boy survived the entire war, and so his history, you know, his brother's letters stopped after 2 years, but he went on. We were talking with Will Sullivan. He was my guest the other day. Of course, he will never say what he thinks they're going to bring because he's like, why put a cap on it? But
exactly.
There have been some efforts by the Historical Society to maybe put some money together. How do you feel about something like that? You know, is that the kind of stuff that you wish people would just donate to a museum? Or do you see that, you know, hey, I found this, so finders, keepers, losers, weepers?
It can come from any number of people. You could have collectors that are going to want them. We are definitely going to be a player. I checked the auction this morning. For the past, I don't know, 2 weeks, it sat at an opening bid of $600. Today it was $950.
That's all, $950.
That's all, is $950. But, you know, it doesn't really matter until you get down to the end of an online auction because they can change quite rapidly at the end of that
auction. See, I thought it might be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
No, I don't think they'll sell for that.
Okay.
What is good, though, is you've got basically a complete set of letters, and you've also got an example of the one brother survived the war, but the other brother, like many people in the Civil War, didn't die from a battle wound, died from typhoid. And you have I think there were more casualties in the Civil War from sickness and disease than there were actually from the battle wounds.
Oh, you are historically accurate about that. That's the one thing I learned from my mother, who was a huge Civil War buff. And I know when we give Civil War talks to small school children, like the fourth graders, Nancy will hold up a cup and say, this is the most dangerous weapon in the Civil War. Because with this cup, they would dip it into a water stream and drink out of it. And that carried all the diseases. And so, or if you got shot, you know, they didn't understand about germs, so they just dug around in there, and so you died of an infection.
Yeah, there's a good scene in Dances with Wolves at the beginning of that illustrates that. And Dr. Tim Jacobs, when he's talking about the Civil War and Civil War medicine, which he's pretty knowledgeable about, he always uses that clip from Dances with Wolves as an example. Some of the kids are mortified. Some of the kids are fascinated.
The boys love it. The girls go, ew. But I remember it was a sold-out movie with Dances with Wolves, and I had to sit in the front row. And trust me, as cute as Kevin Costner is, I almost gave it up in that opening scene. So we're going to learn about Lincoln and Grant and Twain. And how do they come in? What did Mark Twain know Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant?
He knew Grant
well. Yeah.
He knew Grant very well because he was the one who published Grant's memoirs. And that made Grant, you know, at a time when he was financially going up and down quite frequently, he went ahead and made his money really after he had published that autobiography, which is still regarded as a very well done autobiography to this day.
Rescued Grant from
poverty.
We're out of time. Gary Rabine, candidate for governor, is on the line. Jack Freiberg, thank you so very much. We're going to take a break, head up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative, and we come back. A Republican who wants to be the next governor. A lot of them do. We're going to hear from one of them, Gary Rabine, in just a moment. The Mary Griffith Show, our next segment, deals with politics. Oh, aren't we all so excited about politics and all these great commercials, but this is not a commercial. This is Gary Rabine live on the phone with me. Good morning, Mr. Rabine.
How are you today?
I'm wonderful and glad to have a chance to talk to a candidate. You're only the second candidate who's been on my show. I think I really will say this. I think a lot of candidates want to just have these ads where they attack everybody. I don't think they really want anyone to ask them a question. But today I'm going to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind.
Mary, I love questions. I'm never afraid of them.
Okay.
I was in a debate last night in Chicago, and I was asked some great questions. It was a very successful debate against Darren and Jesse Sullivan.
Let's talk about some of the key concerns. The Republican Party has a huge task before them on Tuesday. They're going to meet, you know, pick the person who's going to go up against J.B. Pritzker. Powerful man, incumbency. Of course, has made some mistakes. Some people don't like him. But what are some of the key concerns that you're putting forward in your campaign that people should vote for you? What solutions do you have?
Well, you know what? So my big thing is this. I'm a business. I've been building businesses, blue collar businesses, since I was 18 years old. Started my first company with a couple $1,000, seal coating and patching driveways, and built that to be the biggest commercial paving company in America. We pave in every state in the country today. It's called Rabine Paving, or Rabine Group of Companies. We have 13 companies here. Seven of our companies, Mary, should not be here anymore. When you look at the economics of these companies and the risk, that seven of our companies should be somewhere else, and I'm mad about that. I'm mad that this is a great state that I've been blessed to be part of, this beautiful state of Illinois with amazing people, and that our Illinois regulatory environment, tax environment, tells me, if I use simple economics, tells me to get out of here, and I'm mad about that. It shouldn't be that way. We should be a state where we welcome businesses and small businesses and big businesses to come here, stay here, and build jobs and families.
You come out of a perspective of having actually run a business. You know how to make a payroll, and you know what some of the pressure is, you know, to maybe, like you said, move on. And we here in Quincy are very blessed because we have some local people that they probably could make more profit if they went somewhere else, but they decide to stay, and we appreciate that. What are we going to have to do to turn our population losses back into people wanting to live and work in Illinois?
So those great companies that you talk about, I'm aware of. You got some amazing companies down there. But it's unfair that they should go across the border in Iowa or anywhere else in the country to be treated better. We should be treating them better than anybody else so they stay here and they love our state, just like homeowners. So, I mean, our homeowners are being treated unfairly. Our property taxes now are the highest in America. Okay, that's not fair. That's wrong. So when we look at this, I'm a very competitive person. Again, I've started over 36 companies, and we have 13 today in the Rabine Group. But I got to tell you, when we look at this, we say, what is fair? Fair should be average of the country when it comes to regulation on small business and big business, and fair should be average taxes on a homeowner. The average tax on a home in America is 1% of the value. Where I live, Mary, they're 4%. So on a $200,000 home, where I live, it's $8,000 for property tax. The average of Illinois is over $3,000, and the average of the country is $2,000. Okay, my goal is to get to be the average in costs for regulation and taxes in Illinois. We look at everything, go right across the board, look at average instead of the highest. And when we do that, people will stay, right? We'll gain more taxpayers without raising taxes, but actually cutting taxes and regulation. This has been done, Mary, across the country, and I'm telling you, it works. Indiana did it. Tennessee did it. Even crazy California cut their property tax to 1%, and their property values continue to grow, even though everything else they do wrong.
That's interesting because, you know, I'm not as educated about this as you are, so I call myself the average person, and that's why I ask the average person questions. Property taxes are high, as you mentioned, in Illinois. But that's what our school district operates on. So if you cut our property taxes, how is the state of Illinois going to keep the Quincy public school system running?
That's a great question. I'm asked often, but here's the thing. Other states have done it, and when they've done it, more money for a time that you have to bridge this. So there's a time where our property values will double and triple over a short period of time. Double within 5 or 6 years, triple within, let's say, 15 years in value, okay? Where so when it doubles in value, you get your tax at a higher value, right? So eventually, most of that money comes back, but there's a bridge period of time. But here's what other states have done, Mary. The general fund has to take on more of the responsibility. The community shouldn't pay 70-80% of it. It should be a smaller portion. The general fund should take on a big part of that. But the only way the general fund can take it on, Mary, is we have to go back. We have to restructure our pensions so that they're sustainable. And when our pensions are sustainable, unlike today where we're just above junk bonds, right? We're just above junk ratings, okay? If they're stable and they're sustainable, guess what? Our interest gets cut in half, saving over $12 billion a year just in interest. That $12 billion goes a long way when it comes to the general fund recovering the difference in the school costs.
You talk a great show, and I don't say that mockingly. One of the problems is, yes, we definitely need pension reform. You're a Republican. The Democratic leadership is not really too interested in doing this. So, Gary Rabin, you can say, I'll do pension reform when I get into office. How are you going to work with the Democrats? How are you going to work with the other side to bring some kind of moderate common sense solution? Because labor supports that Democratic Party and those pensions. It's going to be hard to do what you say must be done and what I think everybody agrees must be done, but nobody has the political will to do it.
So, Mary, great question. The Democrats actually understand that we're headed for a crash, and not maybe as clear as they need to. So I'm a person that has been a vision builder all my life. Our business is to be successful. We really think of a moonshot, a vision that where nobody else has been before. And when we get there, success is abundant, okay? When we look at Illinois, my moonshot is by 2025, I want more people moving into Illinois than any other state in America. And to do that, we must rework this pension. And let me tell you, when Rauner was in office, Rauner did a lot of crazy things and a lot of bad things, in my opinion, but bottom line is when Rauner was in office, he actually had the Democrats agreeing to pension reform in a big way. The only blocker of that was Madigan, the corrupt son of a gun that's gone now, okay? Otherwise, he had the Democrats and Republicans alike going along and all ready to sign. Madigan did not want him to have the win. Without Madigan there, I'm confident that with the right vision, the vision of collapse that will happen in a short period of time if we don't change it, and the vision of excellence that can happen when we do change it, we can win them over, Democrats and Republicans alike, and we will call out the bought politicians that don't go along with this. If they don't go along with this, it's because they're bought by the unions, they're bought by lobbyists, and their people will call out.
Well, we certainly have had our share of problems in Illinois. That is without a doubt. If you can, stay with us for a minute. I've got to take a break for a crass political ad, and then we'll be back to continue our conversation. So hang on the line if you don't mind, Mr. Rabin. Thank you.
I'd love to.
We are back. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. I will say, Mr. Rabin, the one group that's profiting the most from these Republican challenges is the news media and our advertising. So I can't complain about hotly contested races. I'm sure I'll get a bonus before this year is done. You talked a little bit about Democrats and Republicans working together. This Republican governor's race has a wide field of candidates with a wide array of ideas. And some are, some people say, well, this person's being bought or being bought by big money interests or this person's doing this. And we've seen a lot of negative campaigning around that. Why, if I'm going to go to the polls on Tuesday, why am I going to pull that lever for Gary Rabin as opposed to the other people that are on that ticket?
So, Mary, I've been in the business environment across the country for the last 15 years, and I've also been involved in starting national organizations from nothing to being very big today. Job Creators Network, we started it with six of us. We have now 400,000 businesses across America. All we do is fight bad regulation against small business, and we've been winning. So it's a great organization that I can leverage business and bring them to Illinois that have never been here before. I have 400,000 captive business leaders that are part of this organization I helped start. Okay. I can get business into Illinois like nobody else. Cat will be back if Gary Rabin wins. Citadel, I believe I can keep him here. So me, a business leader that's been building business for 40 years is the best mind that we can have leading. Okay. And when I talk about Job Creators Network, Mary, we fight hard when there's challenges against freedom and business, okay? And recently, on January 14th, we won the biggest lawsuit. I was the plaintiff and the original plaintiff and funder of a lawsuit against Joe Biden that we won on January 14th against the vaccine mandate. It was a long fight. We won at the lower court. We lost at the circuit court, the Sixth Circuit Court. And then we appealed it right away, and we won at the U.S. Supreme Court. That was for over 80 million working Americans that from there on could choose not to take the vaccine if they didn't want to. It was wrong. It was unconstitutional. I knew that. I have a competitor in Darren Bailey who has embellished his case where he wanted the lower court for his mask mandate, for his own one-person, one-mask mandate. He then lost at Sangamon County. He didn't appeal it, and he's talking like he was the one that solved the mask problem. And God bless him because he did stand up and fight, okay? But when he lost at that other second court in Sangamon County, right, he actually didn't even appeal it. So he lost that case, and yet if anybody listens to him, they think he won the U.S. Supreme Court when I did. So, again, I'm going to fight hard for business, and this was a big case against business that I knew was unconstitutional and employees. So I'm going to do that like nobody else in this race. I'm not funded by billionaires, by the way. I couldn't get the billionaires to fund me because my message is I have common sense and I can't be bought. I'm sorry, but the billionaires that are in this race are billionaires that want a puppet. They want somebody they can own. And I'm never going to be that.
When you take office, if you are elected governor of Illinois, 30-second answer, what's the first priority in your administration?
Well, we're going after human trafficking and the sex trafficking of our minors in our state is rampant, and nobody understands this as well as I do. I've investigated this for the last few years. And I've got Trump's advisor on human trafficking that's on my team. And we've discovered so many ways that they're trafficking our kids, into our state like no other state. All right. We're going after this. The sanctuary state laws have to change. We have to quit being a sanctuary state. We have to embrace ICE. And we sever the communication with ICE with our police. That's got to change. This non-notification for parents when a little girl is pregnant is evil. These things have to change for us to change our state culturally. Economics, I got. But I got to tell you, if we don't change our state culturally, we also fall into a place we don't want to be.
Okay. We're out of time. Gary Rabine, thank you for your time, and good luck Tuesday in the primary.
Mary, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's Rabine time.
Okay. Thank you.